This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
For years here on The Best of Our Knowledge, we've been running our astrobiology series, which, among other things, chronicles scientists' efforts to discover the origins of life. And it's not just life on Earth.
So we help define those goals around habitability and trying to assess whether or not Mars has been habitable in the past to look for signs of water.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from a woman who is a scientist and an explorer doing a long-distance search for life on Mars. We'll also hear about the discovery of a new species of fish in a very unusual and dry location. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Have you ever wondered what it might be like to take a trip to Mars? Once you're there, get out, go for a drive, check out the neighborhood? Well, that's exactly what Dr. Laurie Leshin has dreamed about ever since she was a little girl. Dr. Leshin is the Dean of the School of Science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and she's just about living that dream right now as one of the scientists working with Curiosity, the rover currently cruising along and researching the surface of Mars. The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina spoke with Dr. Leshin about how her dream became a reality.
Why don't we start with that little girl named Lori and ask Lori, why space? What was it about space, planetary discovery, and what's out there that intrigued you?
Yeah, thank you for having me so much. It's great to get to talk some about our science and the direction that it's going. But also for me, the inspiration was really Mars. I am just a little bit too young to remember the Apollo landings, which motivated a lot of scientists sort of just prior to my generation. But for me, it was Mars. I have a very distinct memory of standing in my mother's kitchen as a 10-year-old girl looking at pictures from the surface of Mars from Viking in Time magazine and just being absolutely mesmerized by them.
You and me and the rest of the
world.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Stunned.
And for me, I grew up in Arizona. I was born in Boston, but I grew up in Arizona. And so to me, there was something about that landscape that really spoke to me. I just wanted to reach out and touch those rocks. And it was just that very first memory that has stuck with me all this time.
Tell us about your family a little bit. I mean, do you come from a family of scientists? Is there something there that has motivated you as well?
My father's a physician. I come from a family of physicians.
Ah.
And so in some ways, yes, that's obviously a scientific pursuit.
And we often find discoveries through your work that help physicians.
Sure, absolutely. Well, there's a big tie between the technologies we develop for space, and they often get repurposed for medical use,
sure,
which is great. But I would honestly say mostly it was that I had parents and especially a mother who said, you can do whatever you want. And, you know, there weren't a lot of women in this field 30 years ago. And when I started getting interested, and she just continued to encourage me and put me in touch with mentors, and they really did help me.
Let's go there a little more.
Mm.
You know, we see in New York State right now, the governor of New York and a Women's Equality Act,
mm-hmm,
and still not treated with fairness when it comes to their pay. And I would argue in other areas as well,
absolutely,
depending on who you're working with and,
yep,
for and what the unique situation might be. But was it a struggle for you? What was it like as a woman who was pursuing science?
So for me, honestly, I've never felt a real challenge, a direct challenge because of my gender. But there is always the feeling like you have to perform just a little bit better and you have to speak just a little bit louder to get your voice heard sometimes. And
certainly
so,
could be a minority in the group.
Oh, absolutely. I will tell you the countless meetings at NASA where I was the only woman in the room. countless. So, you know, to me, it's just something that you get kind of used to and you deal with it. But it obviously great mentors, great role models, people like Dr. Jackson at RPI,
sure,
our president, who's such an extraordinary role model, have helped me. And I had women help me all along the way. And so that's, to me, a lesson that I take is to always pass that on to the next generation.
Is there anything that a gender would contribute that another gender wouldn't?
To me, the obvious opportunity of diversity is in a diversity of thinking. I think that the value of diversity, whether it's gender or race or any other kind of geographic experience, is that the problems that we face today as a society are not going to be solved in the same way that they were a generation ago. We need to bring all kinds of ways of thinking to the table, all kinds of minds. And I do think that women do work very well in teams. And I think in terms of science, the big scientific questions are we alone in the universe is not going to be answered by one scientist alone in the lab. It's going to be answered by teams. And the more diverse those teams are, the more likely it is we'll be able to answer those questions.
From a variety of fields, it
Absolutely.
Seems like, too, that all
Absolutely.
These contributions that are being made, whether it be from the geologists or the origins of life scientists
yep.
or the physicists
yep.
or whoever it is, even high school teachers, even the general public that keeps their eyes on space.
Oh, absolutely. There are some fabulous contributions on Curiosity that we're seeing. You know, exploring Mars in the age of Twitter is fabulous because we have so many people out there who are off making our, you know, making mosaics of our pictures and posting them online that aren't even on our team. I was just showing one to my husband last night and we were both just blown away by how incredible the work is that's being done by members of the public.
Well, let's go back to some of your work now. Prior to joining RPI, you served as the Deputy Associate Administrator for NASA's Exploration Systems Mission Directorate. My
that's
goodness,
a mouthful,
that's
isn't
a
it?
Mouthful, huh? So, but, you know, how do you get there? How did you get there?
Yeah, so I took a very traditional academic path. I actually had started working at my local university when I was 16 years old. I never worked anywhere else other than a university, except for the 10 weeks I spent as a summer intern at NASA when I was 19, which helped me kind of get going in this field. And so I had the opportunity when I was a professor at Arizona State University to serve on a presidential commission. President Bush appointed me to a commission that was looking at the future of NASA.
What was that like? Pause there for a second.
Yeah.
Did you get a call from the president's office?
I got a call from the Office of Presidential Personnel, and it was actually funny. The first phone message they left me said, you know, this is so-and-so from the Office of Presidential Personnel at the White House in Washington, D.C. I was like, oh, I'm glad you added the Washington, D.C. part. I wouldn't have figured that out. But anyway, yeah, so it was working with the Office of Presidential Personnel, and it was a 9-member commission, so it was quite a small group of people. I was the kid. I was the youngest of the 9, and one of several scientists on the commission, but also there with, you know, former Secretary of the Air Force and Undersecretary of Defense Pete Aldridge, who was the chair of the commission. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a guy who was whisked away to an undisclosed location on 9/11. So really incredible
yeah.
people, and just with a ton of amazing experience. Carly Fiorina, who was at that
sure.
time the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, who had worked in government and nonprofits and the private sector and even universities in many cases, and could just very quickly come in and assess a situation and had the range of experience required to make very powerful recommendations quickly. And it, for the first time, made me feel the ivory tower
yeah.
that I had always been at universities. And so I thought it's time to diversify my experience, and that will help me make a greater contribution.
Give us a little more there, because it might be one of the knocks against academia, and yet it also is a place where the kind of thinking and abstract thinking that goes on probably needs to be preserved in that mode. So let's talk a little bit more about sort of the benefits and the negatives here.
Yeah, again, I think it's a question of diversity. You want people that have had a lot of different experiences together with those that maybe have stayed on a more pure academic track. And to me, mixing those experiences together is really valuable. And you need people who, frankly, are day in and day out doing the frontline science and discovery, mixed more with people like me who, although I still get to play on Mars and do great work there, my day-to-day job is about trying to enable others to do more. And so it takes a mix of all kinds of backgrounds and experiences to, again, really advance the institutions that we need in this country to keep us prosperous.
What came out of the commission?
We wrote a report in 4 months. It was a race, if you will, to make recommendations to NASA about President Bush had announced some very big changes to what he wanted the agency's goals to be and wanted some advice on how best to implement them. And so we gave that, and a lot of those were followed. And like all presidential commissions, some of them weren't. And
can you give us a taste of one or two? What was recommended?
Oh, well, we talked about the different technology areas that NASA should be focusing in. We talked a lot about trying to form different kinds of partnerships with the commercial sector, which is actually one of the areas that NASA has really taken off in, if you will, which is not just using them as contractors and purchasing goods from them, but actually purchasing services from them. So mm-hmm. that's a big shift, if you think about it. Instead of saying, I want to buy a rocket from you, but I'm going to launch the rocket myself and I'm going to make sure it's the, you know, best darn rocket ever, to say, I want to buy a seat on your rocket. More like, instead of saying, I want to buy an airplane, you say, I want to buy a ticket
sure.
to Chicago. You say, I want to buy a ticket to the space station. And so they really have changed the way they work with the private sector. That's a big culture change in the agency, and it's one that's very exciting.
What is the purpose of that? Is that cost saving?
Cost savings, but also, you know, we've been going back and forth to low Earth orbit for 50 years as a nation, and all government run. If we can't transition some of that to the private sector, it's hard to imagine NASA being able to focus on the next frontier. And so really, to me, that's what it's about. It's about allowing, freeing up NASA from the nearby stuff to focus on the bigger prize, the going on to Mars and asteroids and deep space.
Still to come, David Gustina will continue his conversation with Dr. Laurie Leshin with a look at the Curiosity mission to Mars. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if there are any programs you missed or would like to hear again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the Programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262 to order a copy. This is The Best of Our Knowledge, episode number 1191. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Laurie Leshin, Dean of the School of Science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She's speaking with our science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Let's listen in as David brings the conversation back to the surface of Mars and the Curiosity rover mission.
We're talking about robotics here, and the ability to send signals and to control from a remote location. So let's go there. How do you end up getting involved in this mission to Mars and the second rover, correct?
This is the fourth rover fourth we've rover. Sent to Mars. We had the cute little Sojourner rover, which was just Sojourner. The size of a microwave oven. And then we had Spirit and Opportunity, the two Mars exploration rovers, of which Spirit is no longer with us, but Opportunity is still exploring 9 years later, just turned nine on the surface of Mars. It was supposed to last 90 days, 9 years later. And now Curiosity. So that's the fourth.
So we had some experience, obviously. Mm-hmm. We sought to improve upon that.
Much greater capability.
We saw and were greeted to the video of, was it 23 seconds?
7 minutes of terror.
Oh, sorry.
And it was.
Yes. And it was amazing. I watched it at least three or four times. And to then know that we were able to accomplish that, and it's there now exploring, is just, well, it's futuristic stuff that I don't think when we were kids we ever thought that that might really happen in that way. So now we go back to the little girl, Laurie, who is living out her dream.
Yep, absolutely true.
Talk about how this gets lived out.
Well, first of all, it is a dream to get to be involved in something incredible like this with the thousands of scientists and engineers and from all sorts of sectors, industry, academia, and government labs that have to come together to make something like this happen. So it's a really extraordinary team. So for me, the involvement goes back to the beginning. I've been involved in this mission for over 10 years, since before I went to NASA, actually. When I was a professor at Arizona State, I was asked to be involved in something called the Science Definition Team. So that's the very first team of scientists who come together to say, what are the big questions out there? What should the goals of this mission be at a high level? And so we help define those goals around habitability and trying to assess whether or not Mars has been habitable in the past, to look for signs of water, signs of organic carbon and things like that that might indicate that it had an environment that was conducive to the development of life or the preservation of signs of life, even fossilized signs of life now. So that was kind of the direction we went with the mission. Then the next thing that happens is that NASA says, okay, given these goals, now what kind of instruments should we fly? And they put out a call to the whole community for proposals for instruments. And so I was asked to be by the leads of two of the instruments to be on their proposal teams. And it was a big competition. Lots of proposals submitted. And they selected out of that, well, 10 instruments are now flying on Curiosity. And both proposals I was involved in were selected. So it was a competitive process. And we got selected.
And when you say instruments, what do you mean instruments?
So like a camera system is an instrument. So the rover itself is a big engineering effort where they build the wheels and the main chassis and all this electronics and such. But then onto that, you can think of it like we bolt all these different instruments onto it, like our cameras. I'm actually involved in two instruments that analyze the chemical composition of the rocks and soil, which we can talk more about. So yeah, we were selected. Yay. So that was great. And so then we have to actually build the instruments. So you're selected to build them and then fly them and then do the science. So only now, 10 years later, are we actually getting to the science part, which is the part that I care the most about.
Now the pressure's really
on. Now the pressure's on.
And your whole team comes with you, yes?
Right. So I'm a member of a team led by a man at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and another team actually led out of Canada, out of the University of Guelph. So there's many international members on our team as well.
Now, let's get a little more focused on exactly what you're doing, because this is where you really are at the point of discovery. Mm. You are analyzing these samples that are taken from the soil and determining what are the elements, what's in here.
Exactly.
And that's the question that we want answered. So you have done it. You have grown up into the scientist you dreamed about, and you are now actually going to try to see what, if at all, is there. Is there life on any level?
Right. The whole process of getting us to this point of building this rover, and frankly, it was supposed to launch 2 years earlier than it did, and there were some technological problems that caused us to have to delay the launch. And so it has been a long process. And then we have to survive the whole 7 minutes of terror landing on the surface.
It could be all gone in one moment.
And I have been involved in missions where that were not successful, and it's much more fun when it works, I will tell you. So it was, in that case, by the way, not to defer too much from the science, but for the landing, we were all together. And we were all together at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, where the Mission Control Center is, and all the scientists, about 350 of us, we're all in a room together and celebrating.
And we saw that over and over and over again. We heard it on the radio of you cheering and the excitement, and I am sure the anxiety that was released as a result of that.
Absolutely.
More than anything.
Absolutely. Because all the work that we've done so far has all just been, you know, preparing the meal. We didn't even get to sit down to dinner until we land on the surface. So it was great. We all celebrated, but then we all had to go to work because the rover was on Mars and we had to go and use it. And so literally it was 11 o'clock at night and the rover had just landed and we said, okay, time to go to work now.
Is there a team of technicians that sit and operate and the scientists observe, or how does that work?
So I hope you will be pleased to know that the scientists actually drive a lot of what happens, and we actually make the initial plans for the rover each and every day. The science team is kind of given the keys, which is amazing. We work very collaboratively with an engineering team that stays with the rover that makes sure that the rover is always going to be safe and that we're not kind of going out of bounds on the things that we're trying to do. They won't let us, you know, drive it off a cliff or anything. But that being said, they are there because they want us to have the best possible success with the science as well. So we all worked collaboratively very well. But the way it works is every single day, because the rover is awake on Mars every day, we've always got to be planning, what's it going to do tomorrow? What did we learn today? What are we going to do tomorrow? We put a plan together of the activities that we want to do, and we even start sort of programming that into commands that will be sent to the rover, and that only gets transitioned over to the engineering team rather late in the process. So
how the heck are you even here with me right now? You've got a lot of work to do.
Well, luckily there are 400 people on the science team, so we kind of rotate through these roles. And in fact, my specific role, in addition to being a member on two of these teams, is I've been asked on the broader sort of integrated team. We've now taken all the teams and sort of put them all together to make one big team. I've been asked to be what's called a long-term planner for Curiosity. So I'm one of seven people on the team who are long-term planners. And our job is to kind of not get so sucked into that day-to-day activity, but to keep looking, a few days, a few weeks, a few months out and say, are we meeting our objectives and goals? Are we making progress? Because I will tell you, the hardest and most wonderful thing in the world is the scientists, and I'm going to hold my hand up in front of my face for people on the radio. It's that there's a cool rock right in front of my face. I want to stay here and look at this rock for a really long time. And our job is to say, well, okay, you can analyze that a little bit, but how about we keep our eyes on the prize here? We need to drive to this big mountain that's off in the distance.
Yeah, let's get into this because, you know, some of us are aware of some of the features of Mars over the years that have been described. But the thing you have to do is land in a safe spot.
Right.
And you want to go to the place that you believe will be the best opportunity to draw those samples that will show us that something is alive.
Exactly.
So explain to us, where did it land on the planet? Mm-hmm. And where is it going to gather more evidence?
Yeah, this is a great story, actually. So we've landed on the floor of a crater. It's called Gale Crater. It's a crater that's about 80 miles across. So it's a pretty good sized crater, not that huge by planetary standards. But it turns out to sit in a very interesting place on Mars where water has flowed across the surface, and you can actually see dried up riverbeds. Liquid water isn't stable there now, but we see lots of evidence of dried up riverbeds. And it looks like some of those riverbeds have breached the rim of this crater, and it's got a nice low part in the bottom where if there was water around it would have pooled there. And then it's also got this big mountain in the middle of it that's just beautifully full of layers that we could even see from orbit. Layers, 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 like in the Grand Canyon. And so geologists love layers. That's like candy to us. So it allows you to read the whole history of what took place there in these layers. So it's a place that not only probably had water pooling in the low parts, but who knows, maybe even had deposited some layers there. So our job is to land in the low parts and then drive to the mountain and drive up the layers and really read the message in the rocks. So we're still sitting in the floor of the crater. in this quite low spot, and we turned out to have landed only about 500 meters from sort of the lowest of the low. And so we said, well, even though it's kind of in the opposite direction of the mountain, let's drive over there. And so literally we're sitting there in that bottom place. And as soon as we got onto these rocks in this low region, they're incredible. They're these rocks that look like they're full of mud cracks, and they're shot through with white veins of stuff that look like it was deposited by water. And we drilled a hole into one of those rocks for the first time ever on Mars. We drilled a hole.
It's so exciting. Now, do you get to see, are there video feeds that you get to see of this drilling going on?
So we don't see real-time video from the rover, although we can take video, actually. That's not true, but we don't see it in real time. But we have lots and lots of images. Every single day we talk to the rover, usually between 2 and 4 times a day. And we do that through orbiters that are at Mars. So we have like our own communication satellites at Mars. And so then it sends us whatever pictures it's taken and things that day. So yeah, we keep pretty close tabs on her.
You just said her, so I was just going to go there. Are there any pet names for curiosity?
I just call her like a ship. You know, I think she's a girl.
Dr. Laurie Leshin is the Dean of the School of Science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gastina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series at origins.rpi.edu. The search for new life is not only going on in space. Right here on Earth, there has been a new species of fish discovered in a very unusual place. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Thousands of new species are discovered and classified each year, and many are astonishingly large. Donald Stewart, fisheries professor at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry, reveals how a 400-pound fish was able to hide for more than a century.
This is a story about a fish that was hiding in plain sight for nearly a century and a half. My students and I have been studying the conservation of arapaima in both Brazil and Guyana. These are fishes that can grow as much as 10 feet long and weigh over 400 pounds. For 145 years, biologists have thought that arapaima consisted of a single species, but we have rediscovered a second species. We did not make the discovery by examining fishes freshly caught in the Amazon River, but by locating a monograph written about the fish in 1829. We were led to the monograph because we needed to be clear about the taxonomy of arapaima. So I reviewed the taxonomic literature from the early 1800s. The fish described in the monograph had been collected in the Brazilian Amazon about 1819. In the 1860s, though, it was discounted as not being distinct and subsequently forgotten by the scientific community. The specimen ended up in Munich, Germany, as a dried skeleton. A bomb in World War II destroyed the skeleton and the museum housing it. But the very detailed technical drawings in the monograph from 1829 provided the proof needed that a second species of arapaima did indeed exist. To this day, we do not know the precise locality where this fish was collected, because the German scientist who found it died before saying where, and nobody has found a second specimen. The mystery surrounding the recently discovered fish's status is not surprising. There are still vast areas of the Amazon basin where no arapaima have been collected for study.
That was Donald Stewart of the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions. which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.